Good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my guest co-host, Jack Rubin. Lynn Ware Peak is, as we say, off on assignment. Our first guest this morning, Peter Watson. He's written Convergence, the idea at the heart of science. Watson offers a new approach to the history of science by arguing that the many disparate scientific branches, physics, psychology, biology, genetics, and a whole bunch more, are converging on the same truths. Jack and I look forward to our conversation with Peter.
Good morning. I'm Jack Rubin. And John, thank you for having me on this morning. Our second guest this morning is Ben Reed, the Deputy Director of NASA's Satellite Servicing Projects. Imagine this future scenario, one spacecraft following another satellite, steadily closing the gap, each vehicle traveling at more than 16,000 miles per hour. The satellite is being serviced. It's running out of fuel. The robotic servicing satellite is following in pursuit, carrying life-extending propellant and tools. A fascinating technology.
16,000 miles per hour, a rendezvous. So the satellite that they're going to fix is going 16,000 miles an hour. The robot that's going to fix it is traveling at 16,000 miles per hour. There's no human involved. It's totally autonomous. It's a fascinating story, so we look forward to that conversation as well. These two guests, plus today's cool story, when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back with Peter Watson, who has written Convergence.
Hi, this is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers custom picture framing, rush options, hanging and delivery services, and in-house designers. Open Monday through Saturday, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of Cool Science Radio. Have you been told you need a total knee or shoulder joint replacement? Information about alternatives is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Jack Rubin, our first guest this morning, Peter Watson. Historian, a very strong technical scientific person who's written a fascinating book, Convergence, the idea at the heart of science. Watson delivers a fascinating story of science over the last 150 years that offers a powerful argument that many disparate scientific branches are converging on the same truths. Peter Watson, welcome back, or welcome to Cool Science Radio. Peter, are you there?
I'm there. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, we're all set. Peter, first of all, I understand you are in the Bahamas.
Guilty, yes.
Oh, good for you. Well, we have a beautiful day here in Park City, but we're still in the middle of winter with a lot of snow.
I know. Well, it's not winter here. I think it ever is.
Yeah. Peter, your book really snuck up on me. There were so many moving pieces, and I was patiently going through it, and the whole thing just comes together, just a fascinating book. Tell us, why did you write this book?
Well, I don't know why one ever writes a book. I mean, I've written several books of the way ideas develop, and it then occurred to me that we're actually living, I think, in a golden age of history of science scholarship. Lots of people around the universities are finding out more and more about the individuals who produced science. And I was originally going to write a book based on all that golden historical research. But then it just occurred to me, and I don't know why, that in the 1850s, there were these two amazing ideas, which I still think are the most important unifying ideas in science. And that is the discovery of the concept of energy. And that energy could not be created or destroyed, only changed from one form to another. And that brings together all sorts of different sciences. And in the same decade, Charles Darwin had this idea of evolution by natural selection. That brought together biology, zoology, paleontology, geology. And from that moment, it seemed to me that for the first time in history, the very disparate disciplines began to come together and to support one another. And in the various forms of knowledge that we have, like history, like law, you cannot say that about any other system of knowledge, whereby they all support one another. And it then struck me that that is a very interesting thesis, and the more you look around, the more you see that the sciences are coming together, overlapping, forming established hierarchies. There is an underlying order to the sciences, which I think is in itself just fascinating.
And today we're all familiar with the tremendous collaboration that is taking place in the different sciences and amongst people. You talk about the 1850s. Talk about the environment prior to, say, the 1880s, these closed, separate islands of discovery where people were not sharing information. What was that like, and what affected the change?
Well, I think that there were two or three things that affected the change apart from experimental discoveries. I start the book, unusually for a science history book, I think, with a woman, Mary Somerville, after whom Somerville College, Oxford, is named. And she wrote a book on the connection between the physical sciences. And at more or less the same time, the master of one of the Cambridge colleges, William Whewell, invented the term scientist. I mean, it's a relatively modern term, scientist. It didn't exist before the early 19th century. And the very fact of identifying science as a concept rather than as different disciplines was itself new. I mean, at Oxford, for instance, you don't have a department of physics even today. You have a department of experimental philosophy. That's the old ancient term. So all these things came together around the middle of the century. It wasn't harmed by the 1851 Grand Exhibition in Britain, where the Crystal Palace was first built, and that exhibition had 6 million visitors, all of them interested in science. I think science really began to be popular. I mean, outside the sort of universities and the elite, thanks to that exhibition, and of course many of the practical discoveries in America came around at that time too, and also made science a lot more popular. I'm thinking of Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, and so forth, where you had technological changes as great then as the internet is now.
Peter, this is Jack Rubin. I loved your book, thought it was terrific, and as John said, it was kind of an eye-opener. You read the book, and you go through, and you go, gee whiz, this just makes a lot of sense. What I would like to ask you is, you know, Horace Mann's the guy that kind of chopped up education here in America. We had different classes at different times, and, you know, you take chemistry, and then you might take physics, and you take other courses. Do you think we've kind of been disadvantaged by our view and how we've been taught not to view what Mary Somerville and Einstein and these other guys thought that you bring out in your book, that this is really one big complicated ball of yarn and you can't really just follow one string?
Yes. I mean, well, I think that both approaches are to some extent necessary. I mean, I think that like you, I had a chopped-up thing, and then I trained as a doctor. And, I mean, in a way, medicine itself is a converging science. I mean, you use biochemistry here, a little bit of physics there, and so forth. And you do have to master the basics. But I do think it's helpful as you go along to identify people like Mendeleev, people like Niels Bohr, who amalgamated physics and chemistry, Linus Pauling, who helped amalgamate physics and biology. I do think it's helpful to identify these points at which the sciences do start to come together, do overlap, because it's immensely powerful for understanding the trajectory of science. And as you correctly say, you know, interdisciplinarity is not new, but I think the overlaps of the sciences are becoming increasingly clear, and we are just entering, as I say, at the end of the book, the age of quantum biology, which obviously I think has a long way to go. It's a very difficult science, difficult to do and difficult to understand for many people, but I do think that will be the next step in the sort of amalgamation or convergence or confluence of the different disciplines.
Peter, you're obviously a very erudite fellow, and we're able to take on an incredible breadth of knowledge to weave this book together. For us mere mortals, do you think there's a future out there where there may be a survey course in science, much like Western civilization is for college students today, or used to be? Perhaps that's not so popular anymore, but where you try to put an overview together. I don't, in my educational history, have been exposed to anything of that sort. And frankly, that's why your book was so interesting to me. Do you think there's a future for that in education?
Yes, I do. Funnily enough, we have just found that the book has been bought in China to be the basis for a course in the universities there for precisely what you say, as to give a kind of historical trajectory to the whole way the sciences develop. So it will be a kind of foundation course so that people can organize their thoughts around where science has come from and where it's going. And as you know, I do try in the book to show various points in the past where people have tried to bring this forward. Philip Anderson in America, various people in Britain, and so forth, in just after the Second World War. And so I do think that it could be the basis for a general course, yes.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Peter Watson, who's written a fascinating book, Convergence, The Idea at the Heart of Science. Peter, many years ago, and I don't even know who asked me this question, and I'm not even sure where it came from, but the question was, and it could come from a number of different places, but the question was, is the universe perfect or is it random and chaotic? And it seems to be more of a philosophical question. And yet, in reading your book, I found something fascinating. I always knew that that organisms were self-organizing. And you talk in the book about how even inanimate matter spontaneously organizes itself in Europe. And this is just a fascinating topic. Can you talk about this?
Well, yes, and I think it's a fascinating topic and still a bit of a mystery to everybody. I mean, I do talk about the work of Stephen Wolfram, who says that, you know, numbers behave in this way. He has just run lots of programs in computers, looking at the pixels on the screen and so forth, and you run whatever program you run, you find you get both random behavior and ordered behavior. This seems to be in the nature of matter. And, you know, what happens with my book, I think, it starts off as a history of science, and then towards the end, you're really mixing in the philosophy of science as to what it means and where it stands for. And I don't claim to have any final answers. And I do agree that it's still a bit of a mystery. But we are now getting into this territory whereby matter, and that applies to the universe as well, has the capacity to be both random and ordered. That said, the universe is chiefly made up of dark matter, which we don't even begin to understand. So we're not near any final conclusion yet, but these matters do raise their heads and teach us to ask more and more questions in a certain direction, I think.
Yeah. Peter, if you could define for us reductionism And if you could tell us what the most compelling evidence for reductionism is.
Well, I think reductionism, E.O. Wilson said, is the primary cutting tool of science. It's basically that the world is material, and everything can eventually be reduced to atoms and molecules, and they account for absolutely everything. And I think the most interesting thing I came across in writing the book was an experiment that about 3 or 4 years ago with a paraplegic man, and it was found that by inserting various electrodes in his brain, certain particular cells in the brain were responsible for certain movements that he made, and that, in fact, they were able to predict before he did it which finger or eyelid he intended to move. In other words, intention was also somewhere material. And I think that that's what reductionism really comes down to, that everything is material. There is no magic spirit or force in the world. But we are closing in on these basic forces and units that account for absolutely everything.
Peter, one of the things that struck me in your book, and for those of our listeners that haven't read the book, this idea of tying together so many different sciences is very appealing. Obviously, the leap from physics to chemistry, from chemistry to biology, those are things that, as I say, for a guy like me, is pretty easy to get my head around. What I found incredibly interesting was how you can go from the hard sciences to the social sciences to human behavior and tie those together. Could you take a moment and sort of just expand on how things that seem to be from really not opposite sides of the world, but almost from different planes seem to intersect?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the book sort of spreads out in the last third to discover some of these things. And I trained, for instance, as a psychiatrist more years ago than I care to remember now. And I trained under a man called John Bowlby, who was a psychoanalyst. But he was there was a time when psychoanalysis was very airy-fairy. It's all about couches and things are very difficult to prove. But Bowlby noticed that animals have similar behavior patterns to human beings. And so he began to put together the findings of ethology, particularly of primates, apes, chimpanzees, with what he was observing in the clinic. And he did a very famous report after the Second World War where there were a lot of orphaned children for obvious reasons, mainly in Western Europe and in Russia. And he went around all these various nations. And then he observed that the emotional deficits that a lot of orphan children have were very similar to what was happening in the animal world, where again some offspring are orphaned. And so he started this idea, which was then carried on in various places in Africa, of comparing human behavior and animal behavior. And of course, this led to people to look at behavior in the evolutionary context. And so you got, for example, new ideas of, say, depression, that partly it's a failure to adapt in an evolutionary sense. And it's not a kind of philosophical thing, it's an evolutionary thing. So that's just one example of, I think, how the hard sciences have begun to inform what we might call the softer sciences. And that has gone on in some detail now. And so you've had, for instance, in a paper that I've written, there have been five phases in the unconscious. It starts off in the 19th century as a philosophical concept. Freud makes it a more of a psychological concept. Bowlby made it more of a biological concept. And I'm sure you've had them on your program. Daniel Kahneman, in his book Thinking Fast and Slow, he finds that there are certain aspects of behavior which he thinks are a result of our developing ourselves on the savannah in Africa. These forms of fast thinking are really our unconscious. And we have evolved beyond that. But we haven't got rid of our fast thinking. Some of our life is achieved by slow thinking, but a lot of our things are done by fast thinking. So you've got this evolution of one idea, the unconscious, from a philosophical thing to now it's an evolutionary concept. I hope that helps.
Yeah. Later in your book, after you've laid out this beautiful story that becomes almost self-evident through the power of your writing, you talk about a number of people, frankly, who I didn't know may not have much interest in knowing much about, who seem to be anti-convergence proponents. I'm sure they're very well-researched and knowledgeable people, but after reading your book, you know, I got to that point. I said, gee whiz, you know, how can these guys have a view that's so contra to you? I think you talk about the tyranny of science and some other philosophical views that don't sort of go hand-in-hand with what you laid out.
That's right. I mean, I think that, to be honest, I think they've lost the argument. But it was more fierce a few years ago when the sort of when we were suffering under the force of French postmodernism, which was basically a political movement, really, to say that no particular view should be privileged over anyone else. And that all sounds very fine, but in fact, of course, some views are, let's not say privileged, they're just better supported than other views. And I think that the whole thrust of convergence is that reductionism is a fact of life, in fact, underlying life, and by accepting it and trying to look out for these similarities, it's a far more productive, far more fruitful, and in the end, a far more satisfying way of understanding the world. I'm not to say that my last book was a book of, I have a chapter on poetry. You know, poetry's aim is to look at detail and to look at the very, you know, the very great ways in which the world is different, and I don't for 1 minute object to that. But the similarities in the world, the convergences, the overlaps in the world are equally interesting, in my view, more interesting.
Peter, I'm curious. Many years ago, I heard about this Franciscan friar, William of Ockham, and, you know, after he died, the stuff came out, and they started calling it Ockham's razor, where when you have two competing theories that make exactly the same predictions, the simpler one is always the better one. Was he a reductionist?
He didn't know it, but he was. I mean, I think he was a prudent man. He basically said that the simpler solution tends to be the best, and by and large, you know, it's true. I mean, I've just been reading a history of scientific intelligence in the Second World War. And R.V. Jones, the British guy who ran the British Scientific Intelligence Service, used Ockham's razor all the time. But when they were trying to work out what the Germans were up to, the simplest solution invariably worked. I won't say it invariably worked, because that's a dangerous thing to say, but he, you know, he used that. Ockham was a reductionist before the fact, before, you know, the whole approach really took off.
Yeah. And I'm also curious about one other thing, and I get asked this from time to time by folks that listen to Cool Science Radio. You know, when we cover different things, and like the Higgs particle, for an example, you know, what is the significance of the Higgs particle? And one of the things that I learned in your book, I thought it was this particle that CERN was able to discover, but and that's true, I guess, but that its lifetime is estimated to be somewhat less than a zeptosecond, which is means that it travels less than a billionth of an inch before it decays. I mean, what is the significance of something like that?
Well, there are two answers to that. The Higgs particle gives matter mass, and so without it, we wouldn't exist. And the other answer is that it may interact with dark matter, so it may help answer questions going into the future. The reason that I think physicists are more convinced than most people is that the history of 20th century science teaches us that particles were often developed in theory before they were observed in practice. I mean, take an example, the neutron was first predicted in 1919 and not discovered until 1932, and then, of course, became the fundamental unit in the creation of the atom bomb. So it may be confusing to people not totally au fait with physics, and there are a lot of them around, I should say. Obviously.
Mm-hmm. Peter, if I could just interrupt for a moment. We only have about a minute left, but so if somebody comes up to me and says, hey, JW, what is the significance of this Higgs particle? What could you give me in two sentences that would be compelling?
That it helps us understand, it gives matter mass.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a drag on matter, and it may help us understand the future dark matter, which is the predominant matter in the universe that we don't understand.
Okay. Well, thank you. Again, Peter Watson, who has written Convergence, The Idea at the Heart of Science. Peter, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay. When we return, we're going to have a conversation with Ben Reed, who is the deputy director at NASA. We're going to be talking about robotic autonomous robots that go out and service satellites and potentially will be involved in the recovery and the pushing of asteroids outside of harmful paths to the Earth. Stay with us. This is Cool Science Radio.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features three bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Peter Watson, who's written a fascinating book, Convergence, The Idea at the Heart of Science. Our next guest is Ben Reed, Deputy Director of NASA's Satellite Servicing Projects. On February 19th, aboard the 10th SpaceX commercial resupply mission was a technology module called Raven, which will bring NASA one step closer to having an autonomous navigation capability. When affixed outside the International Space Station, Raven will test foundational technologies and will enable autonomous rendezvous in space, meaning they will not necessitate any human involvement, even from the ground. Ben Reed, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm very excited to be here and talk about some of the projects that we've got underway.
Well, thank you very much. For starters, I'd just like to mention, if any of our listeners find this enchanting, which I hope they will, there's a fabulous video on the web, if you just simply put in Raven NASA, which shows what the project will do, which really looks like science fiction. I understand what the objective of Raven is to allow satellites to effectively link up, at least at the first stage, without the burden of man's intervention through a delay. You're talking about things way out in space moving at incredibly rapid speeds with delicate instrumentation. So sounds like Raven is an unbelievable but critical technology.
It is. If one thinks, if we could just take a half a step backwards about satellites in space, people are often surprised to hear that presently in space, this is globally, not just the U.S., but globally, there are neighborhood of 1,300 or so operational satellites presently in space. Not launched since the beginning of the space age, but presently operational, 1,300. So there's a lot of reasons to be in space, and therefore a lot of satellites are up there doing different functions. And of those satellites in space, a tiny, tiny fraction have ever been anywhere close to another satellite. Most, because space is so big, you can take that many satellites and send them out into space, and the vast majority will live their life completely alone, not ever near another satellite. And so while people think, well, we did in the Apollo days, we had the command module grab the service module. In Hubble servicing days, we had the space shuttle grabbing the Hubble Space Telescope. So, Ben, why do we need rendezvous technology now in 2017 when NASA has conducted these missions in the past? And the big difference is, for those other missions I just mentioned, which are the notable exceptions to the vast majority of satellites in orbit, there were humans involved using their own judgment locally on the satellite that was the servicing satellite that was reaching out to grasp the client satellite, as it were. But what we're talking about is getting human out of the loop, having the speed of computers allowing more rapid modifications to the servicing satellite's orbit to catch up to and safely get close to and eventually capture a client satellite.
Ben, I didn't introduce myself. I'm Jack Rubin. I'm here with my co-host, John Wells. And part of the introduction, which you may not have heard, John was referring to perhaps another application of Raven at some time in the future. The idea of servicing client satellites is something that's, we've all seen that in a Buck Rogers film somewhere. But the idea of finding a threatening asteroid or something else that might be approaching Earth, is that too much science fiction, or is that something that might be in the future for a further development of the Raven technology?
No, as a matter of fact, that is exactly one of the applications that we are working on this technology for, is precisely asteroid rendezvous. For two reasons. One, just to collect science about these near-Earth objects. The second reason for developing Raven Technologies to go to an asteroid is in case one day there was a killer asteroid heading towards Earth, we could have the ability to send a remote satellite, a robotically autonomous controlled satellite out and do something to modify the trajectory of a killer asteroid so it doesn't come near Earth. And in fact, there's a NASA mission on the books today called the Asteroid Redirect Mission. We are intimately involved in building both robotic arms and a rendezvous suite so that we can rendezvous with, land on that asteroid, and bring a big piece of it back to the neighborhood of Earth, not actually land on Earth, but close to Earth. And part of that mission is a planetary defense demonstration where we will formation fly with an asteroid many tens of millions of miles away from Earth. We'll do autonomous formation flying with it, and we will alter the trajectory of that asteroid simply by flying next to it with a technique that we call a gravity tractor.
A gravity tractor. Could you describe that?
Sure. So just as the Earth's gravity holds the moon where it is, the moon's gravity is also pulling back on the Earth, and that's why we have tides. Well, if you were to fly a satellite next to an asteroid, certainly the asteroid is going to be pulling the satellite towards it, but equally so, the satellite's gravity will be tugging on the asteroid. And by firing the thrusters on the satellite so that it doesn't get pulled into the surface, but it stays mighty close, we will, the closer you fly, the better, you're able to alter the trajectory of that asteroid without ever having to touch it. I know in the Bruce Willis movie, they were able to adroitly land on the surface and do the work they had to do, but if it's not quite so easy in reality to land on a fast-tumbling asteroid that maybe doesn't have a good landing spot for a satellite. And so that's why we like developing non-contact planetary defense techniques should they ever be needed.
And I want to mention to our listeners that these are all projects which are on the books for the future. Raven is a piece of technology that went up on the Falcon rocket on February 19th, I believe, Ben, was it? Just last week?
Yeah.
10 days ago?
Yeah, that's right. Sunday the 19th, that's right.
Sunday the 19th. Has it been pulled out of the cargo bay? Have they started to set it up and to start calibrating instrumentation?
Yep. Our three-eyed Raven was pulled out of Dragon trunk. We have been attached to our attachment site on the outside of space station, and an aliveness test was done. That's where we apply power to our payload to make sure that it survived launch. So two thumbs up. Everything so far has been nominal. And for those of you not familiar with that term, nominal is the way NASA describes great. So far everything is nominal. On Friday, tomorrow, deep into the morning hours of Saturday, we will fire the launch locks and raise Raven's head and start peering about to make sure that the sensors are all working.
And the International Space Station is receiving resupply on a somewhat regular basis. So Raven will be used to watch that and to start understanding how some of these technologies can be used in tracking foreign objects that are approaching the International Space Station. Is that how it will be deployed?
That's right. That's right. So if you're going to go to an asteroid in a distant location, you're going to need sensors to see that asteroid. You're going to need algorithms to process not only where it is in space, but how fast is it tumbling. So the algorithms that are receiving data from the visible infrared and laser sensors have to process the images to determine features on the surface of the asteroid. So we're going to take advantage, just as you said, of being on space station as a precursor demonstration or development effort of that technology. So we will be looking at all of those resupply vehicles over the next 2 years and looking at features on the outsides of the vehicles, the location and the angle of their solar arrays, and our onboard algorithms and processors will be determining not only the range and bearing of where the visiting vehicles are, but their pose, so their roll, pitch, and yaw with respect to the space station. And the fact that we could get up there on a SpaceX launch and utilize the infrastructure that exists on space station, the communications network, the attitude control, it's just a fabulous way to rapidly advance technology without having to build a complete new system for each experiment.
Ben, that sounds fabulous. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and I'm sure Raven's technology won't be built in a day either. As I understand, this is a two-year experiment with the idea of asteroid redirect missions in the future. What should we anticipate this two-year window will provide you on your way down that path?
So along the two-year timeline, there will be many visiting vehicles arriving and departing from the space station. Our international partners, the Japanese and the Russian Space Agency, both have vehicles that go to the International Space Station on a regular basis, as well as the two U.S. vehicles, one from Orbital Sciences, Cygnus, and SpaceX Dragon. And so we will be autonomously tracking each one of those vehicles from those various partner companies and countries, and we will be learning with each one what works and doesn't work. We will be, because our processor on orbit is reconfigurable from the ground, we will be uploading new versions of our processing algorithms to see which work best in the harsh lighting and tremendous distances and speeds that are in space.
Yeah,
and so it's just a perfect laboratory for this type of experiment.
Yeah, that sort of gives rise to my next thought. I mean, when you read your press releases and stuff, autonomous is in there a lot, which means, you know, sort of no humans screwing around with it. So the idea that you're going to be uploading algorithms and so forth is interesting. How much artificial intelligence or machine learning or whatever is going to be going on inside of Raven?
Yeah, so the main autonomy that we need is the ability to see the natural features of these client satellites, have them matched to an on-board or on-orbit 3D model of that particular client. So when we look at, for example, a Cygnus resupply vehicle, we will already have on board a three-dimensional model of that, and we will be matching the features. Well, the algorithms are designed to match the features that the sensors are picking up with the features on the 3D model, and from that we will compute not only their roll, pitch, and yaw, but their location. That data will then be fed into a control system that will move, as in the case of Raven, move Raven's head through space to track as the vehicle gets closer. The reason why this is so important is one of the very first missions prior to the asteroid mission, where we will be using this technology, is a mission called RESTORE-L, RESTORE-L. And this mission, at the end of this decade, so just a few years away, we are going to send up Raven technology as well as robotic technology in the form of robotic arms and fluid transfer. We're going to rendezvous with, reach out, and robotically grab a satellite that was not designed to be rendezvoused nor grabbed in orbit. We are then going to cut through thermal blanket, cut through lock wire, remove two different size caps that were torqued on really tight, and then provide 100 kilograms of highly explosive satellite fuel to this client and then release this client as a technology demonstration mission that one can refuel an existing satellite. But if you back up, the first step in that long sequence is a safe rendezvous. So we practice on space station, so when we go to a quote-unquote full-blown client in future missions, we will already have under our belt some additional confidence that it will be a safe rendezvous, a safe capture, and then a successful refueling.
So I would have to believe that the 1,300 satellites that are currently orbiting our planet, that a very high percentage of those are not designed to be captured at some point. Most of them are probably just up there thinking that this capability would not be there.
You nailed it. You nailed it 100%. The vast majority were not designed to be serviced. Two notable exceptions were designed to be serviced: the Hubble Space Telescope and the International Space Station. Other than that, the other satellites up there, all the rest of them, were designed to live their life alone, to never be repaired, refueled, relocated to a new orbit. So we are talking about a giant potential customer base who could benefit from this type of servicing in orbit.
You know, when you said two, there are only two out there, I was hoping the Hubble was one of them. But I thought the second one you were going to mention was going to be the GPM, the Global Precipitation Measurement Satellite that Dalia Kirschbaum and her group at Goddard put together, because that's a relatively new satellite, and I'm sure with Raven being on the drawing boards for probably several years, you know, she may have, or that team may have, put that capability into GPM.
Fabulous question. Wonderful question. And as coincidence would have it, the work that we are conducting at Goddard Space Flight Center, right in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., in Greenbelt, Maryland, we are in the same clean room where GPM was assembled and tested before it launched into space. That is a critical mission for measuring the rainfall around the world and helping to save lives, because we can warn people when monsoons are coming. So we, as they were developing and finishing off their satellite, we were becoming more mature here on campus at Goddard, and we did talk with them. As it turns out, one of the easiest steps a satellite operator can do to make their satellite more serviceable is to take lots of photos. I mean hundreds of photos from every angle and in the wavelength that Raven is going to be looking at it in. So Raven uses visible infrared and an active laser system. So one of the techniques that we like to use on satellites nowadays is to image a satellite before it leaves the ground in all three of those wavelengths, so we have a good baseline understanding of what those features look like in those wavelengths. So if they ever get serviced in orbit, perhaps to extend their useful life with more fuel, we have a good baseline to seed our algorithms with.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Ben Reed. He's the deputy director of NASA's Satellite Servicing Project at Goddard Space in Greenbelt, Maryland. And this is one of the coolest. I mean, the applications for this, I mean, this is really going to be an extremely important piece of technology.
I couldn't agree more. And let me give you another far-out but unbelievably, potentially, world-changing application for this technology.
Can I guess?
When we are looking for life outside of Earth, the existence of life beyond our planet, there are two big categories of ways to do it. You send a rover to a planet like Mars, and you sniff around, you scratch, you dig in the dirt, and NASA has that well underway, as you, I'm sure, are well aware. But another technique is to examine exoplanets, planets outside of our solar system. As hopefully this audience has been seeing in the press, there are thousands and millions and most likely billions of exoplanets nearby that we could potentially look into the atmospheres of these exoplanets to find the existence of life. So you're not looking at an object walking on the surface of the planet, but you're looking in their atmosphere for the telltale signs that life is on the surface. It's really difficult to look at a planet next to a bright star that is many, many light years away. What you need is a tremendously large telescope. So Hubble is big. James Webb Space Telescope is bigger than Hubble. Hubble has got a 2.4-meter primary optic. James Webb has a 6.5-meter primary optic. If you want to interrogate the atmosphere of an exoplanet to find life or the existence of life, you're going to need something around 20, maybe even 30 meters across. That is simply too large to fit inside a single rocket and to launch into space and unfold. That's where satellite servicing technologies, what we've been describing today with rendezvous sensors, with robotics, with advanced robotic tools, it could assemble, clip together, piece together, robotically mate together a tremendously large primary aperture so that we can interrogate the atmosphere of an exoplanet and potentially find life outside of Earth.
That's unbelievable. So basically having a workshop in space that Raven is going to help do the first phase of by bringing the toolbox up.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly right. Yeah, you need this assembly platform to put this together. And I fully anticipate, should NASA undertake this in the future, and gosh, I'm going to try my hardest to make it happen over the next few years and in many years, right? This is an ambitious long-term project. It eventually would be astronauts and robots working together, just as in the shuttle payload bay for all of the Hubble servicing missions. There was a large robotic arm that assisted the astronauts as they made Hubble better and upgraded it across all those missions. Most likely, a large observatory assembly would be humans and robots working together.
Ben, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. We'd love to have you join us again. This has just been a fascinating conversation. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about the potential of another application that I was thinking about. Somebody told me that space junk is just one of the biggest problems that our world has, and I was wondering if there was a possibility of this technology being involved in some robotic trash cans that go up and sort of sweep things up a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. The first step in removing space debris, space junk, would be to find the space junk and then to get close to it and then to reach out and grab it. And those first two steps, finding it and getting close to it, that screams for autonomous rendezvous technologies, which is precisely what our three-eyed Raven is developing. So presently, we have no mission on the books to send up a robotic space debris remover, but we are absolutely developing the necessary technology toolbox that would enable NASA to execute such a mission when the time is right.
Ben Reed, Deputy Director, NASA, and for us, for the Game of Thrones fans out there, yes, Three-Eyed Raven, the answer is yes. Listen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, I've really enjoyed it. Invite me back anytime, and I'll gladly say yes.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
All right. When we return, just some final words.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
And I want to thank our guests this morning. And well, let me thank our sponsors first. San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Davidson Orthopedics, Nexus IT, and the Natural History Museum of Utah and Park City. We, of course, want to thank Peter Watson, who wrote the book Convergence, and our most recent guest, Ben Reed, Deputy Director at NASA. And I also want to thank my guest host this morning, Jack Rubin. Absolute delight working with him. Everybody get outside and have a great day. NPR National.